Welcome to Earth Matters Now on Community Radio KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kyrs.org. It's Tuesday, January 27th, 2026, and it's noon. I'm Laura Ackerman. We have a special two-hour show today from noon to 2 p.m. talking with Nick Jeffries, the wildland resource planner for the city of Spokane, and local author Jack Nisbet. We're talking wildfire, ponderosa pine forests, and the history and culture of wildfire in the region.
And I'm Mike Peterson. The views we express do not necessarily represent those of KRS. Spokane high temperatures in the upper 30s tomorrow and low to mid 40s starting on Friday with some rain showers in the middle of the week. And we'll just get going with our interview. Nick Jeffries is a wildland resource planner for the city of Spokane. Jack, you're the author of 9 books about Pacific Northwest history. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Nick, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so yeah, I was actually raised locally in the Spokane Valley. I grew up in Green Acres. I went in the military and did some service overseas in Iraq. When I came back, I went to Gonzaga University and Spokane Community College and got a degree in environmental studies. From there, I started fighting wildfire in 2008. We have progressed in the wildfire and forest health industry. I worked for the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management. I worked for the Department of Natural Resources. I did 10 years with the DNR. And about 4.5 years ago, I got hired with the Spokane Fire Department as the wildland resource planner. So sometimes that's confusing because I work for the Spokane Fire Department, which is part of the city of Spokane. And I have a family. I still live locally in Liberty Lake, and I have a custom antler lighting business that I build antler chandeliers. And so that's kind of a wrap on what I do.
And Jack?
I'm a writer, but I didn't call myself that for a long time. I moved to Stevens County as a kid after growing up in the South. But I did natural history as a kid, taught by my mother and grandmother. And in the early 70s, got a column with the weekly paper in Chihuahua, like what bird is that, what flower is that, very simple column. But over time, it allowed me to go all over the place and make some great tribal contacts who helped me understand what I was missing. When there was a big fire, I got to go look at it. And then I had the column for years and years and had to write every week, so I would go back and back and back on fires and see what happened to them over time. Many of the early records were by these two white guys, David Thompson, who was a fur trade and a cartographer, and David Douglas, who was the first person in our area to collect birds and plants and animals systematically. And they both had a lot of interesting things to say about fire, so I was naturally, anytime they had something in their journals, I would remember that and mark it and use it later. And over time, wrote a couple books about Thompson, did a museum exhibit about him, did the same thing with David Douglas, and then got on to a man named John Lieberg, who homesteaded on Lake Ponderay and did the first systematic ecological survey of eastern Washington in the early 1890s, and was a tree guy, really, and did all the forest surveys and the forest reserves for what became all the national forests in the Idaho Panhandle, western Montana, eastern Washington, and on down into Oregon and California. Amazing guy. And when he was at Lake Ponderay, he saw a lot of fire before the city of Spokane burned in their famous fire. He was documenting fires and how the railroad, you know, how steam locomotive puts out sparks. He was documenting things like soil temperature and how hot fires sterilize the soil. He was just an amazing resource. And in time, he's exactly halfway in between David Thompson in the early 1800s and Nick in the early 2000s. So I use him a lot as a sort of a benchmark for how the landscape developed from the way it was when Thompson had first contact and saw it, and what we're in now, where we're having to do mitigation and try to do fuels reduction and the kinds of things that you have to work with and see every day. So I don't really think about anything but the landscape. I mean, that's all I'm trying to get at. And people are part of the landscape mm-hmm. to me. I don't make any distinction between human history and natural history. So I don't have any choice but to get around to fire because it's so part of our world.
Nick, did you think when you were growing up you would be doing this kind of work?
Definitely not. You know, life has a way of taking you places. And, you know, my combat time really defined on who I am and how I operate, which then put me in these places where I was a service forester helping private landowners and, you know, going out and getting treatments done. And what I think I really liked about that is the fact that we could actually treat acres and make a difference. And so that has had me thrive into the position that I'm in, where I'm, you know, actually getting mitigation done on the ground. And it's just been a wild ride. But no, I definitely didn't see myself here.
And Jack, what'd you want to be when you were a little boy?
I don't know. I don't really think like that, I guess. Everybody in my family is either a farmer or a doctor. And I knew that I wanted to be both. And I guess I got to be. I don't know. But I will say that when Nick was working for DNR, whenever I had a question about these things, and that's when I was really getting involved in it, it was Nick Guy Gifford, your boss?
He was.
And so Nick's boss and I became pretty tight because I was always bothering him about questions. We did a lot of walks together. We cored a lot of trees together. We looked at a lot of bad habitat together. And I sort of got to understand the concrete part of it. What Nick's talking about is actually doing something about it instead of wringing your hands. And I love the tribal method of setting a fire, but since we can't do that now, what do you do? And Guy was the beginning of getting an answer to it. Difficult question for a lot of people, but when you're Nick, here's my job, I'm going to go do it. And that's what I love about it. I wish everything was that simple.
I know.
It's not, of course.
I know. It's not that simple, but yes, I agree with you.
Well, what are wildlands in Spokane, in the city of Spokane? It's kind of an interesting term to call Spokane having wildlands.
Well, and wildlands and wildland urban interface are kind of the same thing. We have an integration of forested lands that our city's built in. I wouldn't say that, you know, we are built into the wildlands, right? So the forest was there first, and then we put houses and people everywhere in it. And so these wildlands are huge amounts of it, from municipal ownerships to private ownerships. Everywhere you go, there's going to be fuel in between houses. And when I think of wildlands, I think of fuel. I think of forests. So, you know, you always have that forest health aspect in the back of your mind, but really, it's a fuel loading question and a fuel problem. So the wildlands for the city of Spokane proper, we're going to say that the city owns about 12,000 acres. Of that 12,000 acres, 3,500 of it is unimproved property, that needs some form of management. And that's just a vague definition of what the city of Spokane is. We have Riverside State Park, which is thousands of acres. We have private lands, which is thousands of acres. And all these different entities tie into one holistic community that we make of Spokane.
And the way I deal with that is my wife Claire and I have sort of systematically during these last 40, 50 years gone and gotten all the early artwork that we can find. There's a lot of pretty interesting artists that followed the fur trade routes that David Thompson set up in 1807 starting. And you can look at those and sort of get an idea of where the city was when it began. And so there's, during the Boundary Survey of 1860, there's a really talented American painter who painted Spokane Falls. And you look at the area around it, and there's nothing but ponderosa pine, and they are on such big centers that, you know, people are whining about the clearing that Nick does maybe on the Palisades or on the Bluff. They're on 150, 200, 300-foot centers. I mean, there's not very many there. They're widely scattered. Then as you come down to Big Eddy, they get denser, but they're still quite clear that they're getting burned on a regular basis. Then there's a photograph from 1880 of the first Spokane Bridge. It looks exactly the same. Nothing has changed. The tribes kept burning. I mean, I have a lot of elders that talk about when they were kids setting fires in the Colville Forest, you know, to clear things out, and the rangers coming and putting them out and going, "What are you doing? You're crazy." And they're going, "Well, but they need, you know, it needs refreshing. It needs fuel reduction. It's stagnant. It needs to be burned. And there's these fantastic tribal quotes that describe what Nick's trying to do, but you can't, you know, in a city, you can't burn. So that's the problem.
So I was at the Inland Tree Conference, and you were speaking and showing some of these photographs, and it was kind of amazing to me as a big fan of ponderosa pine how there just weren't a lot of other trees or anything. It was like,
if you go out into the wildlands where Nick is mostly working, there aren't, it's ponderosa pine with shrubs underneath it, and the state of the shrubs and the state of the pines is what Nick is looking at. You know, that's what you can talk about, is how do you decide how much to take out, what kind of centers to put on.
Right. Well, and, you know, I guess our historical data shows us that we put very large ponderosa pine has lots of space, but we don't always have that because a lot of this stuff was cut down and logged and put into industry. And so our forests are kind of like almost the negligence of logging / we've really done good at suppressing wildfires. Like, we've done a great job at doing that. And so we have these huge fuel loads on the landscape. And so when we go in and we look at that, we want to put them back towards their natural state. Now, obviously, without fire, we're not giving it the 100% treatment. We're giving it, I'd say, the 75 or 80 is what we like to call it. We're giving it the 75 or 80% treatment by doing fuels reduction. The reality is we're looking at 15 to 20 foot spacing between the large ponderosas, taking out a lot of the small regen as ladder fuels, pruning up the trees. A lot of times it's shaded branches that they're going to shade and fall off. But, you know, because they've been so suppressed, there's just a lot of material underneath there. And so we help that process by pruning them up, and then we're disposing of it by chipping or masticating.
So when you're looking at wildlands, Nick, are you just looking at it from a thinning point of view? Is there something else that you're trying to think about in terms of forest health, to use a term, besides thinning it?
For sure. Well, you know, you're basically going to put on different management hats. Okay. So if I'm on private land, maybe my number one management goal would be wildlife, right? I want to produce large deer so that I can have them on my property. On the city ownership, it's a tricky one because you have many users. Then you have forest health implications, so bark beetle, pine beetle, you know, dwarf mistletoe, all of those different things, root disease. And then you have the wildfire side of things, where we're pushing these large volumes of untreated land right adjacent to these big wildland urban interfaces where we have the potential of a catastrophic event. And so it's really a tricky thing that you're trying to make management for all these different variety of reasons, if that makes sense.
And it's, I think what a lot of people don't understand is how fast things grow. So John Lieberg, again, is this central figure to me. He does a plant survey of the Hangman Creek Valley in 1893. He sees a lot of the plants that you can go on the list now. It's a beautiful looking place. There's areas of it that are old ponderosa pines that are looking pretty good and are very open on very big centers. Then you can go around a corner and have a mess. And Nick just finished a project there that's kind of amazing to look at. But John Lieberg is not thinking that. He's in 1893, and he's saying, yeah, there's all these sawmills here in Hangman Valley that have already cut all the logs they're going to cut and closed down. And there's all these truck farms here, some of which are run by Japanese people. I mean, what is going on here? This is not what I thought Spokane was. But so it's been 100 years since then, 125 years. So when Guy Gifford and I were doing walks there, we measured trees. We bored trees that were 350 years old. And when going over Nick's work that he just did this fall, I just counted 225 rings on a tree. So they're... They didn't cut everything down. They cut. I would love to know how many big pines they cut. That's what I'd like to find, is that photograph from 1893. And that photography was certainly there. There must be one somewhere. But it's such a dynamic system. And when we say we're trying to get one thing, it's never one thing. It's always in a mosaic of old and new and trashed and fertile soil and bad soil and here was a fire. It's always so complicated. And that's what Nick has to take into account right. when he's doing a job that does, people are looking for one outcome. It's a million outcomes.
It is a million outcomes. And everybody, you know, everybody has a different goal and intention, right? And so we have to take that into account. But we also have to think big picture. Like, I think why I always come back to fire is because that's where my career's been. But I know we are primed and ready. And so it's a matter of where these fires start, where these catastrophic events are going to have.
So you, ponderosa pine forests used to burn low intensity. And now we're looking at high intensity in some cases. And you didn't, you had a successive forest. You didn't have everything. You can always tell when a forest has been logged because a lot of the trees are the same size that have, that they've replanted. And ponderosa pine forests, my understanding, were not, you know, they, it was just like generations of humans. You had older humans, taller humans, younger humans, smaller humans.
That's fair to say. It was mixed aged stands, but it was, there was, it was also messy. There's a great photograph that I showed at the event Mike was at last week where this a great photographer, Aishel Curtis, came and took a beautiful picture that I'm sure a lot of forest regenerators look at, where the pines are on perfect centers and everything is spaced out perfectly. And if you look over to the left where he didn't point his camera, there's this mess of dog hair and all this stuff. But you know, artists and photographers lie all the time because they remove humans. They pick what they pick where their lens is. But if you're walking across one of Nick's jobs, you got to see the whole thing. And again, it varies. The treatment, the person who's running the masticator has to think every time that they move, every time they crawl another 10 feet, it's going to be different.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the holistic view of the bluff, when you really think about it, like we masticated 84 acres of that. And It's a vastly different approach than the hand crew side of the other side. There was also some sections of the hand crew side that had such heavy brush that I think if there was a fire, it would cause a significant issue. We also left a strip down the center where the, it's not a creek, but it's
Rocket Gulch.
Rocket Gulch, mm-hmm. Straight down that. And, you know, for habitat purposes, for a lot of different reasons, for a lot of different variations, you can leave that and still get away with it from a forest health standpoint for the most part. And so it'll be interesting to see what the holistic view of the bluff looks like when we're done. So we did the 220 acres this year. We did the 84 mastication and then the rest in hand crew chipping. And then we did another additional 84 in the last 2 years, which was what, a little bit of chipping and a little bit of mastication. And so we've done almost 300 acres on the bluff.
You're talking about the high drive bluff, just for listener's sake.
Just for listener's sake, the high drive bluff, that big patch of timber in between Qualchin Golf Course and thousands of homes up top.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I guess, so from my point of view, all I want to do is go walk that with Nick, walk the job with Nick this spring, but I want to do it next spring and 5 years from now and 10 years from now, 20 years from now. And we're all always in such a hurry for gratification that it's a patience thing. It doesn't come back tomorrow. Forests are on a much longer time scale, and that's why the tribes turn out to be such geniuses at managing land, because they've had 10,000 years to fool with ponderosas. And again, in the quotes, the tribal quotes that in that slideshow that Mike saw, they say a lot of really interesting and sometimes counterintuitive things. I mean, they go, yeah, we just burned the whole side of this mountain because it was just so overgrown and so stagnant. And the white people just can't believe that we would just burn the whole side of the mountain. But in the long run, it's better for it. It needs refreshment. And that's hard for a lot of people that just walk the bluff every day or might have only walked it for a year, and all of a sudden it's like different.
Vastly different.
Yeah, there were a few people at that meeting who,
yes,
who had some problems with
they were ready to go
with
go
the in. Large openings. And yeah. And there's, you know, people like Dominic De La Sala, for example, who basically claims, no, all you need to do is fire harden your houses and don't worry about thinning the forest. It doesn't work. It makes it too open for fires and wind. What do you think about that?
I think that in our fuel model, we know that thinning fuels reduction is actually an efficient tool from a forest health and a wildfire standpoint. The forest health side of things is we're giving the trees the resilience to withstand insect attack, essentially giving them more water, sun, and nutrient to protect themselves long term. I think from the wildfire side, it's obvious, and we have actual documentation that shows that in the event of a wildfire in a thinned unit, we have the ability to better fight the fire, firefighter safety. We have the event of retardant and air and gel water drops being able to penetrate the forest floor, because what happens is it gets so thick that that water, that gel, doesn't actually hit the forest floor, therefore not allowing for effective firefighting. And so I think we have to look at this as a holistic thing, that we know that fuels reduction works, and we've proven it in this county.
Well, and when you've talked about nature coming back, it comes back a little bit quicker, and there's a lot of scientific examples of that, like Mount St. Helens came back much quicker than scientists realize, taking down some of the dams, like the dam on the Elwha. Salmon were just up there like the next year, and this is true on the Klamath as well. So
on the other side of that, though, and this is John Lieberg speaking again, he talks about the way that prospectors looked for mines in the really steep Coeur d'Alene country, is they would see a rock outcrop and just torch it off so that they could hit the rocks better. And sometimes that fire would get really hot because there was a lot of fuel underneath it. And he said that it would get so hot it would sterilize the soil so that only Doug fir and lodgepole pine would come back. And then it would burn again, and you get into this dog hair burn kind of cycle. And he couldn't figure out how we're going to get out of that cycle in 1895. Well, we're in that cycle. I mean, we're living that in the entire West, and it's hard to get out of. And it takes the kind of, there's all these weedy questions I want to ask Nick. Like, when the duff builds up too much, the gel will bounce off of it rather than penetrate. Is that sort of what's happening?
Well, the duff's still going to burn. So, you know, the duff is a fire we can fight. I feel like from a firefighting standpoint, the duff isn't necessarily a problem. We do have these 100-year layers of duff that are going to be an issue long-term, because areas that don't burn, you're not getting any foliage coming back underneath. But right. From a firefighting standpoint, I don't see duff as being an issue.
Okay.
Other than it does burn so hot that it bakes the roots, right? So then we have that aspect. So then we're 100 years later, we're having some of that come through. Even if it's a light, grass burning fire, it's burning those 18 inches of duff layer and baking the root systems on these big ponderosa pines that should be able to withstand wildfire. And so we're seeing those bake those trees and kill those.
And there's no shortage of examples. The ones I like, there's a great fire that burned up the Little Spokane, where there were a lot of 350-year-old pines. And to see how that's playing out, that's 5 years ago, maybe.
Was that Painted Rocks?
Yeah. Okay. Then there's one in 1991 from Firestorm 1991, which is sort of how I date the beginning of our fire paranoia. That burned. There's all these amazing fires you can look at. And in Dishman Hills, there's one up Eiler Creek where you can go stand up and see how the fire came down. Look at the mosaic that's come back. Look at the reseeding and how it's coming up. And it's, I've been out there with foresters a lot who will say, you know, this is all nine bark, and the ponderosas are going to come up and shade out these shrubs, and it'll look great. But it's not consistent. It's much fingers coming down hills and draws doing it differently, and willows hanging on longer than they seem to. It's always hard for watch it come back because it doesn't play by the rules of the forestry school.
That's forests, right?
Yes, yes, exactly.
That's a good point. Don't play by the rules.
And one of your challenges, Nick, is that you can't use fire. You can't use prescribed fire, right?
Well, so that's a good question. So the prescribed fire is a great tool, and in the county, I think it's going to get stronger over the years. In the city of Spokane proper right now, it is not a good tool for us. And the reason it's not a good tool is a multitude of things. Number one, the complexity of the wildland-urban interface and the housing around. Could you imagine, even if we thinned the bluff first, all of it, putting a prescribed fire on the bluff, how would that go politically? It wouldn't work. But the reality is that in the county, we think, and by we, I'm speaking from my city hat, but I'm also speaking from the Spokane County Wildfire Mitigation Coalition. They think that there's longevity in prescribe fire within the county in certain areas. And if we can get it started in certain areas, you know, start on the outskirts, we can work internally. And they're actually offering stuff to private landowners if they're interested. There's not a lot of momentum with it yet. And I hope that long term, as we get through some of the mechanical fuels reduction, that we can start looking at some of the commercial side harvests or the actual prescribed fire, putting it back on the landscape and getting some of these forests the most resilient we possibly can long term.
So long term, what does that mean to you?
Way past my days. I always say that I want to show my kids what a healthy forest looks like. I grew up in Spokane thinking that a healthy forest was what we were looking at. But what I have learned is that we are extremely overstocked with our fire suppression. We've done such a good job with the fire suppression that we've overstocked our forests. Would that be accurate, Jack?
Yeah. From looking at the early photos and paintings, yes.
From our historical data.
Yeah.
And so when I grew up looking at that, I want my children to look at the forest in a different way. I want them to say, hey, even though we are good at suppressing fires, we had to do this, you know, forest management long term to create an environment that we can actually live with fire. And there's articles out there about living with fire, but the reality is fire is not going away.
No.
If anything, it's getting worse, stronger and worse. Right. So the reality is we have to do something to put ourselves in a good position to actually live with fire.
So we're always going to have to live with fire. It doesn't matter whether we harden our house.
We always have lived with fire.
But yeah. We just maybe are not aware of that because we're so industrialized. So what when you, let's say that there is some prescribed burning in Spokane County. We all know examples of prescribed burns getting out of control in the United States. What do you do? Let's say you have a successful prescribed burn. What happens to the forest? Do we just leave it? Whatever's burned is burned. Some of the ponderosas are still standing. They're not burned. Some are burned. Some people think you should go in and log. What do you think?
Well, we have great examples to look at down at Turnbull where they consistently burn, or Riverside State Park. They've really done it. The number one thing you learn is once you start, you've got to burn it again. Yep. 10 or 15 or 18 years, whatever. There's this great landmark study that was done on the Colville Res that where they looked at rings from old trees, and there was a burning cycle of, 10 to 15 years, something like that, it was consistent, and it was all over any of these open forests, and it was people setting fires. But you can't stop once you start. And there's some burn bosses on the west side that I've spent a lot of time with, that where things grow faster, of course, and they're trying to burn Douglas fir out of the Puget Trough, where it was kind of David Douglas saw open grass meadows, prairies, oaks, and running trees, not as much Douglas fir, and they start burning. And it gets complicated very soon because there's going to be a lot of introduced weeds that come in. Mm-hmm. There's going to be people whining about, you know, all the same things. But once you start, you can't stop. And that's true of managing, too. That's true of your job also, I think. I think you might get another round before you retire, Nate.
Well, yeah, we'll see about that. But, you know, the goal is to put a treatment on the ground, and then the maintenance is really a simple thing. You know, we're out there just weed whacking small trees, you know, leaving one here and there. The first go around is really the big money, the big work. And I feel like even just looking at what we've done on the bluff, like I think Friends of the Bluff could dang near finish the management on the maintenance side on an annual basis. What they do is they go back through and they hit the regeneration trees of those smaller diameter ponderosas that are coming up.
I agree with that. Yeah.
And really it makes a simple process for long-term management. Now it's not gone. It's still there. You know, there's still work to be done, but I think the big push is the first chunk of work.
So when you did the mastication, compare that to chipping and trying to put 6 inches of chips down or 4 inches of chips down that regen can't come up.
Yeah. I, you know, it's a give and a take. I liked the masticator for the project that we did on the bluff. And the reason I did is because the amount of fuel that was there and the amount of dead and down that was there was excessive. And so with a chipping environment, and if you look on the side that we chipped on more of the south end of the unit that was done above Qualchin, there's a lot of dead and down on the ground, a lot of debris. And so, you know, that's a good thing from a habitat standpoint. But from a fire standpoint, that's going to add intensity. And so, like, when you're looking at a stand and you're looking at the right tool for the job, I think that some of what we have to look at is what the fuel load's going to look like when we're done. Like you were saying, you know, some of those areas have 6 to 8 inches of chips on them, and it's going to suppress any grasses or forbs that are coming up below that, which is not necessarily a good thing. It really needs a fire to burn off some of those, right?
Yes.
I'm not hoping for a fire on the bluff, but, you know, a fire would solve some of that problem.
It would be instructive.
Right. The mastication side chews up that stuff and mixes up that duff layer on the top. And so you're not seeing as much suppression. And so we're actually a suppression of the grasses and forbs. We are actually going to do a little planting in there for some native plants, deciduous plants through the Spokane Conservation District. And I'm going to work with Friends of the Bluff on it to hopefully put some material back in there. In my opinion, there wasn't a lot of deciduous stuff in there because there was so much stuff over the top that it was all suppressed anyway. There was so much dead and down, and there was so much tree cover, canopy cover, that there just wasn't a lot growing. It wasn't a thriving forest.
We're going to come right back. We've got to do a station break. You're listening to Earth Matters Now on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1, 92.3. We have Nick Jeffries and Jack Nisbet talking about forests and fires here in Spokane. So let's continue on. I do have one question, though. What about, isn't there a way to maybe remove some of that chipping material, masticated material, and maybe haul it over to the waste energy plant, make biochar out of it, that sort of thing?
There would be some ways to do that, but you'd have to, number one, have cost associated with that. Everything has a cost, right? And it has to make sense. One thing that we're looking at is that material is way up on the bluff. And so in order to get it into a truck, to get it down the hill, to get it anywhere, would just be exponential cost. The other thing is there was some, and I don't remember all the terminology, but there were some big burners. We actually have one in the county that I know of. And the whole thing is there's state laws and Spokane Clean Air and a lot of other entities that regulate our smoke. And so what it doesn't allow us to do is use these burners. So like one idea is like there's these incendiary burners that you can bring in on a trailer. Basically, you start burning the material from a fuels project and you just keep feeding it and it burns so hot that it doesn't create a lot of smoke. Well, those types of devices are illegal in the state. And so like there's just a lot of things that we don't necessarily think about, even though it might be a great idea to put them into play would, make us go through a lot of headache or heartache, or maybe it's not even possible to change these municipal codes or these laws that allow us to do these things.
Well, maybe we should stop and you can explain how a masticator works.
Yeah, right.
We should have started.
I was just going to ask that question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So really there's masticate means to chew, right? So we're chewing up the material. It's basically a skid steer, like a bobcat would be. And then they drive it through the forest with a big mulching head on it. That's typically the ones we're using in the forestry environment. And they literally just chew the material up and blow it back out into 2 to 20 inch pieces. It's not big enough for bark beetles, but it's small enough to decompose. That's typically what we're going for. There is other types of masticators, and we've used them in the county. There's bigger machines that are excavator-type machines that have a rotating head on them that basically come down on the tree and mulch it as it goes down. Either one of these machines, you could literally just run over trees. It's like a giant lawnmower for the forest.
And what about compaction and tire marks and those kinds of things?
Good question. So on that note, Typically, the machines we're using are the lightest skid steer and excavator types we can. Now, there was a project in Spokane County that used large excavators with masticating heads. And what we learned was that's not the right tool for the job. I think it was efficient in what it did, but when we look back in hindsight, looking at what compaction and what tracks and what trails we left, we didn't necessarily all agree that the final product was as good as it could have been. And so we are still learning. And you know, as the coalition, the Spokane County Wildfire Mitigation Coalition, grows, more of this work is happening in the county than ever before. I can tell you, just from what I know, that there's thousands of acres planned right now.
So in some cases, like on the Bluff, because it's so steep, a masticator may not be the best tool to use, or there have to be parameters for it as opposed to something that's like flatter. So part of it's just the nature of the land.
Nature of the land, the topography of the land. So in the Bluff, when you think about this, we had a section of 84 acres masticated. That was really the section that wasn't the steepest of the slope, and it was the densest of material. So that's where, you know, cost matters. Okay. I would be lying if I said any different. Cost does matter. Mm-hmm. We have to think about what it's going to cost to put these treatments on the ground. We have grant money, we have other state monies, we have partners and all these great things going for us, but we still have to think about costs. On the other part of the Bluff that the masticator was not on, it did not make sense from a slope aspect or from a fuel thickness aspect. So it's not that I want to put a lawnmower on every inch of the Bluff. The goal is to reduce the fuel loads. And so we used another tool called a tracked chipper. So I want you to think of like what an arborist used to chip up branches near the power lines. We use what's called a tracked chipper. It's basically like a giant rubber tracked machine that drives through the forest on a remote control that can be hand fed by firefighters and hand crews, and then that chip is put back out, broadcasted onto the forest floor. And typically, chips and mastication material do not burn well. And we talked a little about that. Other than, you know, the depth of them, you know, if they're all piled under a big pine, it could cause forest health issues like bark beetles. But it could also, you know, burn so hot that it burns the root systems as well. So other than that, they don't really burn well, and they don't really cause a problem from a wildfire side.
So the city doesn't own these masticators or this equipment. They generally contract it out. Is
correct. Or we use our partners' equipment. The state has different resources. The State Department of Natural Resources, mm-hmm. who I used to work for, has a lot of different tools. And some of that is funding through the 1186 bill that's passed down, through pass-through funds and through equipment operators and different things that's funded through that House bill.
And so do you leave the masticators on a place like a Bluff where it's steep? Do you just leave them there the whole time instead of like moving them up and down?
Yes.
Every day?
Yes.
Just to reduce the amount of, you know, tracks that it causes. And I know some people on the Bluff have been concerned about that. So how do you, because you can see the masticator tracks and it, you know, can cause erosion, it upsets the soil. What do you do in response to that?
Okay. So as far as erosion goes, you know, we haven't seen a ton because we're leaving a lot of the root systems in place. We haven't seen a lot of like significant erosion events in the county that's going to cause like a landslide. Like we haven't seen anything like that. And I haven't heard of anything like that in the county. And I've worked with a lot of different partners for a lot of years in this industry. As far as the tracks go, yes, it can leave tracks. So what we've done is we've hired hand crews to come through and hand move that stuff back to, because how you leave it is really how it's going to look for the next 30 to 50 years, mm-hmm. as far as the ground cover goes. So trying to minimize those. This winter wasn't perfect because we didn't have much of a freeze at all. A lot of this work takes place from September to about May. Part of that is bark beetles, but part of that is because the contractors that work are fighting fire in the off season. Mm. The other thing is you have industrial fire precaution levels that we have to pay attention to. So we have to pay attention to the fire hazard in the woods. Like, do you really want someone working on a chainsaw in the forest in the middle of August? Probably not.
Right.
That's not the best time to be doing that. So to answer your question, we are addressing some of those ruts, but you know, nothing is going to be absolutely perfect, but there is the hand of man to some extent right there, but It's the same as the suppression side that we've done for 100 years. It's just a different type of hand of man, right?
How does the suppression side, I mean, because I would think about noxious weeds maybe getting into some of those masticating tracks, but humans inadvertently or intentionally not realizing the consequences have also introduced invasive species into our forests. And that is, you'll see that in prairies like cheatgrass. That's a big challenge as well in terms of that might add to the fuel load is all of our invasive species.
Yeah, we're getting into it now. So it's, again, it's plant by plant. The first cheatgrass in the United States was collected by John Lieberg on that 1893 survey near Ritzville. And he recognized immediately that it matures very early and will be a fire hazard in the summer because it'll already be dried out when some of the other stuff is happening. And that's what's come to pass is a lot of people blame the increase in wildfires on things like cheatgrass being a fuel that wasn't there before. But I think what's maybe more what I try to think about so it doesn't drive me crazy is he has a list of weeds that he sees when he goes across eastern Washington, and some of them are really familiar and some of them aren't here yet, and some of them are, he says might be a problem and it's gone. We nobody's ever heard of it. Each plant has its own life history, mm-hmm. too. And again, they're on a much longer sine wave than we are. And so there's always going to be the next problem weed. You know, the rust skeleton weed can drive you crazy on the bluff and you think it's going to, you know, but we don't know what the response it is to burning or mastication. But again, I think Nick is right when he says we need an organization like Friends of the Bluffs that has an army of volunteers, or the Master Naturalist class that the Extension Service runs, where you get a lot of volunteer hours and you go out there, and if there's a new thing or something's bothering you, you have a weed day or you have a rake day, and you get human power to fix up some of these things. And that seems daunting in a lot of the areas, but on the scale Nick is working, it's completely possible. It's impossible. It's possible to get 50 people to rake 80 acres if there's, you know, rake the ruts out. It's possible. And I think it's taken me a long time to understand that that's what is going to happen. Fire covers a lot of bases, and we need a whole array of solutions to cover all those bases.
Yeah, and we think of, well, Friends of the Bluff has actually volunteered in some of the parks in that area to plant trees. It's just expanding our thoughts. Like, well, you might actually need to pull out some of those seedlings if they're in the wrong place.
Yeah, exactly. Planting trees is not always the solution.
Yeah. Right. So I want to talk about, because you've mentioned it, Jack, and just a little more background on the history of fire and the history of fire suppression. And a lot of people date that to the 1910, the big burn. And that kind of changed the Forest Service, or I think maybe even the Forest Service was invented then.
It's in a way, it's a false narrative in that John Lieberg is seeing smoky summers, and he's seeing why their fires set. And it has to do, the way he puts it is, the world was a slow place until the railroads got finished. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a slow place until the Mullen Road is how he dates it. He's going to sawmills in the 1890s and counting rings on trees and seeing what their long-term history is. And with the Mullen Road, traffic increases. There are a lot more fires, a lot more frequent for him. Then the railroads start coming through, and everybody's building a little logging railroad up into the Priest or wherever, and it really gets into a lot of fires. Then you get a lot of dog hair regrowth, depending on how hot the fire was, and it becomes a problem. And because he's going around doing these surveys, so the forest reserves were set up in the 1890s. Nobody really knew their boundaries or what was in them or what was going to become of them, but it was the Teddy Roosevelt conservation world, and mm-hmm. he set it up. They were all professional foresters from Yale who did European-style forestry, which is different. Didn't really apply that well to the West, you could say. And Lieberg gets hired to do the surveys, and he starts out with these wonderful plant lists, and he's going around and coming up out of the Coeur d'Alene Res down into the St. Joe, say, and saying, man, the reservation looks great. And down in the St. Joe, where all these miners and loggers are, it is a stone mess. We've got to think about how people aren't paying enough attention to the landscape here. He does the same thing going up out of the Nez Perce Reservation and down into the Clearwater. The reservation is managed and looks like a park, which Europeans love. The other side, where the prospectors have been and where they're just starting to log, is a train wreck because nobody's being careful. That's all he's asking. He's all for mining and logging, but he wants people to think about it while they're doing it. And he's seeing all these. I mean, again, we don't need to get too lost in them, but it's the same questions we're facing now. You know, Nick is paying attention to what he's doing on the bluffs, but it's not simple and it's not neat. It's never going to look like everybody wants it to look like. It's not going to look like Manitou Park, which I think some people want it to look like. And how is it going to come back over time? And we have all this. There's data to think about that for 200 years. We can think about that now because of these historic records. And the fact that the 1910 fire happened went just when these forest areas were all surveyed out. They were laid out the boundaries and called it Payette National Forest or Clearwater National Forest. And then they're part of the big burn. Then there's the outrage. Then there's the political problems that add another layer of hard things to deal with. You know, politics is the temperature of the public is a hard thing to gauge. But in my mind, you know, Nick saying that it wouldn't go over right now to do a carefully managed burn on the bluffs, it wouldn't. But we're a lot closer to being able to do that now than we were 20 years ago. No question in my mind. And on Turnbull, they can do these carefully managed burns, and you can go look at them, and people think, oh, that's neat. They're burning down at Turnbull. 20 years from now, 30 years from now, when the mastication project that Nick is finishing up on all the Palisades, the Bluffs, or Dishman, wherever, people might say, oh, well, now maybe this time we can do a light burn on it because it's so beautifully done. It doesn't take, you know, we can eliminate, instead of having everybody with the rake, they can just be running the fire line and working like that. I can see that happening. We might not be alive for it. But again, it's expanding your idea of time is the only way to have any hope about this
And then there's a 1991 firestorm. And my understanding is that out of that came the Washington State Fire Service's Resource Mobilization Plan. What do you know about that, Nick?
Well, I'll take it into words that I do know. So honestly, 91, I was 6 years old, just to date myself. But the reality is what we have now is we have a hazard mitigation plan with a community wildfire protection plan underneath it. Everybody in the county, all the players, are in this community wildfire protection plan that then allows for planning for long-term fire suppression. As far as we use this as a tool to apply for different federal and state grants. As far as it for planning purposes, I think the coalition is where the momentum is for our county. So we have a hazard mitigation plan that's almost complete here in the county, done by Spokane County Emergency Management. And then under that, there's a community wildfire protection plan, and it's basically individualized for each district. So I'm part of the city, so we have a chapter in it. And it talks about different things for the suppression side of things long-term. Where the focus is for need for fuels work and other things. It's a very in-depth plan and got a lot of information. The coalition as a whole is just sometimes less about where the CWPP, the Community Wildfire Protection Plan, goes, and more about where the funding is coming from. Because a lot of times what happens is the funding tells you where you're putting money. As weird as that sounds, I don't know if that's so like I was awarded a grant. The city of Spokane was awarded a grant. My boss, the fire marshal, and myself wrote a grant through the Community Wildfire Defense Grant. And we were awarded $1.5 million with a match of $375,000, so it's $1.875 million to put on the landscape for treatments within the county or within our jurisdiction. With that, we have the ability to put that on an array of landscapes. But what happens is other funding comes through, like They have these priority planning areas through the state. And so they'll be like, well, we have a pot of money. Let's say it's $100,000 that we want to put on the landscape, or a crew that we want to put on the landscape, but it has to be done in this priority planning area. And so there's layers upon layers of planning involved in this stuff. So it might not always make sense from the highest risk, and people might question why we've done more work in the Palisades than we have on the Bluff. Well, part of it was funding sources, definitely. Part of it was funding sources. So we've done, I don't have an exact total, but we've done probably 800, 900 acres on Palisades Park, and we've only done 300 on the Bluff. And in my opinion, the Bluff's as high or higher of a risk, even though we haven't had the starts like we have at Palisades every year.
And is that because of the homes on the Bluff and the way fire goes up the Bluff?
Just the way the fire is going to come from the southwest, it's going to push right up. If we had if we had the perfect incident across the highway, it would throw embers. It would start somewhere towards the bottom third of that slope, and it would really get some momentum and fly up and throw embers all over the South Hill Bluff.
So, go ahead, Jack.
One thing that's different about the Palisades is there's been a bunch of fires over there that are real noticeable. I wonder if that had something to do with that the funding headed that way.
Honestly, I can tell you that from where the priority landscape part, it would probably play a part in that based on the amount of suppression that was there, which then would then turn the funding, So I think in a roundabout way, yes. But sometimes those pass-through dollars, they're hard to put on the landscape because you have to have actually a large area in a short period of time sometimes. It's not always perfect, and it's not always a perfect scenario. I like to say that I can think outside the box, and that's why I'm successful in putting projects on the ground. Like, we have a project going right now on the Spokane River. It's a fuels reduction project, and so there had to be a lot of different things that happened before we even thought about putting treatment on the ground. And so what's happening is they're thinning conifers 15 foot apart. So only the pine trees, essentially. So there's a few firs in there, but it's mostly pines. And we're thinning those and dragging them back so they can be chipped or masticated. We're leaving all the brush and all the stumps, and we've gotten Department of Ecology approval and lots of different things. But that project's going on down by TJ Meenock Bridge right now. And I think these are the important things that are happening in the county that we need to be aware of.
So, and can you tell us more about the coalition? Do you spend a lot of time talking to other coalition people about which machine has just come out or, where the funding sources are?
So the Spokane County Wildfire Mitigation Coalition, I am a co-chair with my partner from the Department of Natural Resources, Jessica. We started this coalition about 2 years ago, and our whole intent was that there was partners always working together, and we're like, hey, we can put this on the landscape. How do we do this? What's the best avenue? And we're like sharing resources and sharing skill sets and like, hey, I can come help you with that, even though it's not in the city. I think that I can help you put that on the landscape because it is complex. There's a lot of complexity to this stuff. And so we came up with this coalition. Right now, we have extreme amount of momentum and probably one of the best coalitions in the state, let alone, I would put us up there. We have 30 or 40 active members. Right now you have to have a sponsoring agency. So we have every fire district in the county. We have Avista Power, Inland Power. We have Spokane Land, the Lands Council. We have Dishman Hills Conservancy sitting in. We have what other entities? We have county and municipal entities. So we have Spokane Regional Health. We have Spokane County. We have Spokane County Parks. And so all these different entities are getting together on one page to be able to help each other be more successful in the wildfire mitigation practices. Whether that's home hardening, which I'm sure we'll talk about today, or fuels mitigation.
And so in 1991, when we had Firestorm, I can't remember the cause of that.
Oh, well, look at the U.S. There's a fantastic report online that I think there's a link to it on my website someplace, because I've done a lot of stuff with that, written a lot of articles about it. And it was a seminal event. I would say 1910 and 1991 were very similar in that they made people aware of fire and unfortunately made them terrified of it at the same time. Whereas the tribal way or Nick's way is you aren't terrified of it, you're living with it. Mm-hmm. It's a very different mindset. But the 1991 event was 100 fires that were some really unusual weather conditions, late fall, that was just this red flag day. It's the reason your pulse races when it's a red flag day coming up in the paper. And it started 100 fires. And Guy was on, I don't know if Guy's told you what he was doing that day, but he was on Newman Lake with one person. And there was this fire, and they were out trying to do it. They go, wow, this is too big for us to do anything with. And they realized there was a crew right next door at the Idaho Lake, next to them at Hayden Lake.
Hauser.
At Hauser Lake. And they went over, and they were trying to work together. And then all of a sudden, and they didn't have any radios, and then all of a sudden a radio call came in. There's 98 more fires like this. So what do you do? What do you do? And so it's the first time that they were utterly overwhelmed. And that leads to things like what Nick is talking about. It is 35 years later, and there's a plan now. And I'm assuming that if another day like that happened, it wouldn't be quite so overwhelmed. But they'd still be overwhelmed. If that fire that Nick's describing comes up the bluff and showers embers on 50 homes, you're overwhelmed. There's nothing you can do about it.
That fire was geographically sort of south of the bluff.
No, there was 100 different fires.
All over the county.
But all over the county. But all, over, the, part of
all
it.
Over our part of the state.
How were those fires started?
Most of them, 80% or something like that, were trees on fire lines. So that's why Avista's in the coalition. They have
power
to be
lines.
In the coalition.
Yep, okay.
Power lines,
yeah.
Fires.
Yeah, not all of them, but about 80%. And they're in this report. They went and tracked down every one of them, the acreage, the number of houses that went out, the cause. It's utterly fascinating, and it's the seminal event. It's the rule book for that Nick has to keep in mind when he's playing the game. And I got totally immersed in it because Jess Walter was a young reporter on the spokesman. Mm-hmm. He tried to get out on the Ponderosa fire, which was the one on Eiler Creek. And they turned him away because the fire line was there. And he went back to the office in the days before cell phones and just started answering the phone. And 1 week later came out with a report that was the spokesman put out on the fires with fantastic photographs and all put together. It was the beginning of Jess as a player to me. And to walk it with him was really fascinating. I took him out on a couple of the fires that he had never gotten to go to that he'd only gotten reports from. And you get the difference between the perception of fire and the reality of fire that you can only get when you go out and fight fires. I mean, nobody understands what it's like to fight a fire unless they're on one. And every fire is so different. You have to go. It's an experience thing, I guess, more than anything.
Dynamic,
else.
For sure.
Yes, yes.
It's a dynamic event, yes.
Talk about
everyone.
Burning some adrenaline.
Yeah, we have an hour left. If you're just joining us, we have to take a station identification here. You're listening to Earth Matters Now on Community Radio, KYRS. 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm Laura Ackerman along with Mike Peterson. This is Earth Matters Now. We have a special two-hour show, so we're going to go from one to almost two with Nick Jeffries and Jack Nisbet.
So the 100 fires that started, of course, they didn't go out immediately, right? I want to talk about underground fires a little bit and have a personal experience of doing a little prescribed burn up in Ferry County and then weeks later, seeing a little smoke and going out that night with my infrared glasses and seeing entire tree roots still glowing. But what's your experience?
And that's what Nick was. We'll let Nick answer that one. That's what he's talking about with the duff and
Well, and so what happens is with the wildfire, they get down in the root systems and they just smolder for days because there's no oxygen or very very little oxygen to provide it. So it goes really really slow and slow burning, and it grows way down in these root systems. I think in Spokane County, you have a very diverse, the south half is a ponderosa Doug fir complement, and the north half can be a very, very thick mixed conifer stand. And so you get two totally different fire behaviors there, and you really do get different root systems and stuff. My experience fighting fire was that a lot of times in cedars, they go a long ways, and then the aspens are all connected. So they go in mm-hmm. aspen roots, and they go, you know, these aspen stands are scattered throughout Spokane County. But they'll burn from tree to tree, and they'll just be smoldering for days and days and days and weeks.
Because they're
and
a
weeks.
Clone, right? Because it's the same aspen. It,
yes,
yeah, it's
the
an
same
aspen
thing.
Clone.
Yeah, so they can continue to burn. What we were referring to earlier about baking the roots is like basically you put so much heat and intensity in the ash that you're actually baking the roots, literally just kill them off. So they do burn down into the root systems as well. It gets really hot and it just burns it all and makes the big ash pocket, which then you don't have any roots. How are you going to, you know, feed your tree?
Or it's going to kill the mycorrhiza and the whole fungus world that's part of the whole system.
That, right.
And that's hard to come back. That takes a long time. So at the meeting, at the Bluffs meeting at the women's club, there was a woman trying to explain the mycorrhizal crust, but she was thinking of it in terms of a surface. She was thinking of it in terms of a surface long-term shrub step. She was trying to describe kind of shrub step.